Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, my house guests, there is Nick Newman.
Howdy.
Danny King.
Danny.
Hey.
Danny.
Sorry, my quick computer mishap.
God damn it. And there is, of course, Amanda Waltz.
Hi, guys.
Hello. Okay, so today the only thing we'll be talking about is Queen of Earth, the newest... Hey, I did it. I did it right. I didn't say...
Oh, look at you.
I didn't say the Queen of Earth. I didn't say Queen of the Earth.
The Queen of the Earth.
I'm growing up right before our listeners' ears. So that's the only thing we'll be talking about today. Before we get into it, I would like to remind listeners at home, do you like the show? Because if you do, you should go on iTunes. You should give us a star rating, leave us a comment, let us know how we're doing. You can also, of course, follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. We had some good feedback from that this week. A lot of people seem to be enjoying the show. And, of course, you can email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com. In fact, we had someone who sent us an email. That is Jacob Seaver. Sever? Seaver. I'm going to assume it's Seaver. Jacob, I'm sorry if I'm saying your name
Severe.
Wrong. Severe. he said, I've been listening to the show for about a year now, which is awesome. Thank you. Never emailed Yay. Before. That's cool. It's fine. You emailed us now. That's all that matters. He was super happy to hear that the newest episode was on Dolan's film. That, of course, was Tom at the Farm. And he says, however, I'm going to say that I disagree with a couple of things Brian said in this episode, which I'm cool with, because usually I don't get shouted out at all in these emails. He had a different interpretation of the ending, which said that he really hadn't figured that Francis, the older brother character, had accepted his brother's homosexuality. And he didn't think he was hiding it from his mom to simply protect her, but because of his own outright denial. I have given due thought to this. I don't believe it to be so, but... Jacob, I appreciate you writing in and letting us know that. He says that he gets upset whenever his little brother's brought up as gay, and that he knows in the back of his mind who his brother is, but tries his best to live with his own delusional world. That sounds closer to the truth. Part of me really wanted to watch the movie again after receiving this email to see if it scans, but I think that my interpretation that I formed for myself might have stood. But of course, it is the magic of cinema that people can watch the same movie and come to different conclusions. He also says that he thinks this is similar to Ryan Gosling's character in The Believer, which is a good film about an anti-Semitic neo-Nazi that is also a practicing Jew. We also talk more about The Gift, the movie that will not leave this show. He says he agreed and disagreed about my view of the ending. Yes, Bateman's character is absolutely a bad guy. You're damn right. He doesn't think he's the bad guy, which I would disagree with, but we went through that last week. He also says that Amanda is unforgiven for not liking the Beatles, that is a crime which is unforgivable.
And then, that was how many episodes ago that I said that?
Quite a few, but apparently it's been gnawing at the back of Jacob's brain, and he brought it back to our attention, because I don't think we've given you enough shit about that.
Hey, man, I'm just a Wings fan.
Band on the Run is Wings. Infinitely better than any possible Beatles
yes.
song. I hate you so
Jets,
much.
Jets, masterpiece.
I hate you. I hate you. I hate you. I hate you.
Yeah, I kind of wish I knew this, too.
Wait, the I don't like the Beatles?
Yeah, it's... I mean, look, you know...
Why is it so unbelievable that someone could possibly not like the
because
Beatles?
Because if you're a human being with ears and a heart, you should like the Beatles.
Here's a question.
No.
I have a question for you, though. What abject garbage do you decide to listen to during the day that you can elevate above them? What do you listen to, you know, like...
Listen to leisurely?
Yeah, like what's the last thing you listen to and you're like, oh, that's a good song?
What was the last thing I listened to? Bully? I don't know if anyone knows that band.
No.
Moving on.
Oh, go. Fuck you.
The last thing that Jacob said, which will segue us into our review, is, but to make this email not seem like a full-blown attack on Brian, I'll just say, I do not like sushi at all. That's something we went over on a previous episode. And I have not enjoyed any Alex Ross Perry films. I'm glad you guys will be discussing Queen of Earth. Thank you, Jacob. Because I'm eager to give him another shot, so was I, Jacob. I really dislike Listen Up, Philip, and it took me multiple plays to get through it.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't see that as being that surprising, because if I hadn't had to talk about it that day, it would have taken me a while to get through Listen Up, Philip as well. So that's it. Thank you again, Jacob, for writing in. Fuck you, Amanda, for not liking the Beatles. What the hell's wrong with you?
And fuck you as well, Brian.
Fuck you very much.
You know what I'll say, though? I'll stand in the middle here. Of course, Amanda's wrong and stupid, but that sort of attitude, Brian, it's not really in the spirit of the Beatles. You know?
That is true. I'm really not being one with the Beatles when I say that.
Yes.
Yes. I don't the need that anger. All I need is love.
Yes, the love you take is equal to the love you make.
Oh, that brilliant lyric. So brilliant. So brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
So right.
I'll come over to your house and unplug your I'll come over to your house and unplug your speakers when you're listening to Green Day or whatever it is. I don't know.
What the hell is wrong with you? Listen to anything other than the Beatles? You
Amanda,
do other music has been recorded since the Beatles, right?
What we didn't
They're
mention
not
is
the
that
end all
Amanda
be all
is
band.
A huge Monkees fan.
I do like the Monkees.
So, Queen of Earth is the fourth film by director Alex Ross Perry. And we've talked about two of his previous films. That was The Color Wheel and then Listen Up, Philip. When was Listen Up, Philip this year or was that last year?
That was last year?
It was October of last year.
I guess much year. Like a mugging, Listen Up, Philip always feels like it was just yesterday.
That's a strange comparison.
So Queen of Earth is his newest film, and of course we were going to talk about it, because apparently it's become a meme for this show that everyone knows how much I dislike Alex Ross Perry. So we obviously saw this coming, and it's got Elizabeth Moss in it, and Patrick Fugit, the Fuge, and we like both of them. It's got Catherine Waterson, the daughter of Sam. So, I mean...
No.
Isn't she?
Did I don't make know. That up? Somebody look this up.
No, she is.
Okay.
She is?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I'm pretty sure we talked about that when we were talking about Inherent Vice.
I think there's even a resemblance there, too.
Oh, yeah, there totally
is. Yeah, I
was
going to say, yeah.
Definitely in the eyebrows. So, you doing all right?
That was pretty great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So this movie is about two friends who go to a lake house after one of them, Elizabeth Moss's character, whose name is Catherine, is dumped by her boyfriend shortly after her father kills himself. So this is the newest film by Alex Ross Perry, as we've said, and as we will continue to say, because I feel as though most of this discussion will not be able to separate this work from our feelings about the artist in general. So, here is the trailer.
It drives me crazy that places like this are so close to the city.
Places like this?
Yeah, you know, where tranquility isn't just a myth. Thanks for the exile.
That's what this place is here for.
From Alex Ross Perry, the acclaimed writer-director of Listen Up, Philip and The Color Wheel, comes an exploration of broken women, Queen of Earth.
Been here before?
Just once last year.
Be careful now, you never know.
You never know what?
A week at the lake.
Who the hell are you?
Me, Rich.
He likes to hang out sometimes.
Relaxation, peace and quiet, but under the surface lurks emotional imbalance.
So guys, Queen of Earth. What did we think about it?
You're going to have to call on someone.
I know. I'm trying to think of who I want to hear from first. I'm going to say, you know what? Let's throw a curveball. Danny King, what did you think of Queen of Earth?
I did not see this coming. I did not know I was going to be asked about this film.
I was hoping to coast. Yeah, I'll, just silently in the background.
I'll kick things
did
off
you not,
here.
Did you think this is a Beatles podcast today?
I thought we were going to be talking about The Gift once more. But
we can. We can still make that happen. It's not too late. Remind us first of what you thought of Color Wheel and Listen Up, Philip.
Yeah, I've liked all of his previous movies. Listen Up, Philip was one of my favorite films from last year. I'm very, very much enjoy Alex Ross Perry's films. A little setup for this one. On Wednesday, Woody Allen's movie Interiors was showing. And it was the day that Queen of Earth opened in New York, so Perry was there to introduce the movie because he selected it to sort of screen after Queen of Earth opened. And he introed the movie and talked about how he was talking about the idea of the follow-up and how Interiors – has anyone seen Interiors?
No.
Okay. It's the movie Woody Allen made right after Annie Hall, and it's basically his first full-on drama and his first kind of like stab at Bergman. And there's humor in the movie, but it's basically humorless. And the way Perry worded it in the introduction is like, you know, Woody Allen made this movie Annie Hall that everyone loved. And then he basically just went off and made this movie that nobody asked for and people didn't really know what to do with it. And so that was sort of the framework he set up for Queen of Earth in terms of, you know, I think the movie is actually similar to his previous films and it looks like his previous films. I think the shot selection is sort of similar, but the tone is way different. And so it is interesting seeing this new movie so quickly after Listen Up, Philip. And I think it was shot in a short period of time.
It was like 13 days.
Yeah, like kind of on the quick. And so I do kind of get that feel from it that, you know, so far it hasn't necessarily stuck with me as much as, say, Listen Up, Philip. But I still really liked it. His style is so heavy on close-ups. And so, you know, the whole movie just left me completely uneasy. And there's a scene like 15 minutes into the movie or something around there where it's a shot of both actresses and they're sitting on like the deck in their backyard. And it's one of the first like longest shots where you can see both of their bodies in the whole image. And Catherine Waterston does something with one of her arms where she like crosses it. And for like the first minute of that scene, it looked like her character didn't have like a left arm. And I was like, it took me aback so much because it was literally the movie's so heavy on close-ups that I thought for like a minute, like, okay, this shot is telling us that her character doesn't have an arm. And I was just like, and then she finally moves it or something. And I was just like, shit. And so, did anyone have this?
Did you think they were just disembodied heads?
I thought they were just heads.
That is wonderful.
Yeah. So I needed to share that.
I think the movie can end here. I mean, whatever the podcast can end here. Like, what else can be said about this film?
But yeah, that's sort of the tension I really like from his style, where you'll have a shot on one of the actresses' faces held for so long, and through that he builds like the scene through, you know, where that actress is looking, what you're kind of hearing. One shot like I remember that's like this is when I think it's Patrick Fugit's first scene, and so it's like Elizabeth Moss is coming in with her ex-boyfriend, but it's a flashback. And, you know, suddenly the camera's zooming in on her face slowly, and you can hear all these things in the background, and you can picture the scene, but like he's really wants you to feel claustrophobic and get you physically just so close to these characters that it for me is very gripping. The score is, I really enjoyed that. It's kind of like, it's pretty over the top, but the whole movie is. And so I enjoyed that. Trying to think of anything else I can say for now.
I still can't even tell if you liked it.
I did. Okay. I really liked it.
Because you said it didn't stick with you as much as the other
ones.
Yeah,
not so far, but it seems like it's maybe a bit more of like pastiche, but I did really like it, and yeah, I'll pass it off for now. Those are some initial thoughts.
All right, Nick Newman.
Well, thank you for the words on cinema, Danny.
As always.
Yes, as always. So yeah, I saw this almost 3 months ago at a press screening as part of New York's BAM Cinema Fest, illustrious festival in the borough of Brooklyn, New York. For some reason, I'm reviewing this like I'm Colonel Kurtz. But anyway, I saw this.
Saw the movie, and it was like I'd been shot with a diamond.
And it was interesting because I went into this I was able to see this before there were really many reviews of it. Really, all that had been written about it was out of Berlin some 4 months prior. And so I went into it with, you know, high expectations because I like his work a lot. And because the premise is interesting, and the idea of this Elizabeth Moss-led psychological thriller of some sort is very intriguing. And I remember feeling a certain sense of dread, not the kind I was hoping to feel, during the first, let's say, 10 to 15 minutes of this movie, as it is laying out who this character is and what she has gone through, what she is going through. And accepting a really wonderful opening scene, which is just entirely on her face as her boyfriend is breaking up with her and she's weeping and she's screaming, accepting that, I found a lot of it to be kind of saying rather than evoking and establishing things through these very clear sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge bits of language, such as, you know, well, with what happened to your father, you know, or after the relationship ended the way it did, you know, or, I mean, God, considering some of the stuff you've been through, you know. And so I remember sitting there, I was thinking.
I want a movie written by you that is just statements like that.
With like a weird, like, smirking laugh afterwards.
And so.
And as did their score.
And the thing is, because he's a very verbose filmmaker, I was thinking to myself that perhaps some of his instincts and the things he's done in the past that have served him well were kind of serving him wrong, that his, you know, fascination with language and the way that people communicate with each other was spelling things out too clearly in a way that just wasn't very interesting. And then the movie, I think, kind of shifts keys a bit, and then it starts, once it lays the groundwork for who exactly this person is and why she is the way she is, it goes inside her head. And the film becomes, I think, only more and more subjective as it progresses. And there are these weird little notes. This movie kind of reminds me of Phoenix, in a way. Mm. And I say that because I'm going to use a term that I use when we discuss Phoenix, which is that there are sort of these harmonies and dissonances in the movie with what you expect and even what has been established so far, where it is, you know, very self-consciously this close quarters, limited cast movie, where just the introduction of Patrick Fugit's character really feels like an intrusion. And then suddenly there's this scene with, and it also kind of, you know, it seems to pride itself on having a psychological realism that doesn't have the typical signifiers of a thriller or any film of the sort. And yet there is this scene with a guy who is hedging, who is clipping hedges or something. Who is kind of the classic, oh, you better watch out for, you know, don't go down that road there or something. Like the classic.
Don't go to that old Indian farm over there.
Exactly. It's that kind of thing.
The old Indian farm?
Isn't that from...
It's Pet Sematary.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's basically like Judd Crandall in Pet Sematary. And I'm watching it, and I'm thinking, what the fuck is this? This is so strange. And what's funny is that the movie doesn't really underline that point exactly. There's almost the implication... And I don't know, this could just be me reading a bit too much into it, but there is kind of the implication that that person doesn't even exist, that it's actually a projection of her anxieties and her kind of needing to communicate with somebody else in the world. And yes.
Yeah.
And so there was things like that that were kind of like accumulating. And then as the movie goes along, there are just these there are these odd notes of kind of, you know, not being certain if your best friend is really your best friend, if they intend to do you harm. And I think anybody who has lived with somebody they consider their best friend has those moments where, because you sort of exalt them in your mind, if they do something that isn't characteristic of somebody who you exalt, then you begin to ask a lot of questions all of a sudden about, you know, who they are, who they might be. Then again, maybe that's just me being super paranoid, projecting my own insecurities and fears onto this movie.
We all know about Nick's paranoia.
Yeah. And so it's things like that that really kind of, you know, shook the movie up for me and made it really interesting. And I also think it's funny how his fascination with close-ups, which was really effectively used in Listen Up, Philip, comes back here. And there's this quality of it that's similar to it, which is that it kind of feels like the people in the movie are completely alone, even when they're with other human beings. And there is this kind of, there's this extended shot that goes on for, you know, several minutes of Moss and Waterston talking to each other. And it almost feels like they're talking to themselves. Like there's nobody else there in that room. It's just one person there, just kind of speaking to themselves. They feel very alone and isolated in the moment. And that to me is a really kind of, you know, it's this very exciting, very unexpected mix of what the movie is doing formally and kind of what it is trying to say emotionally. It sort of snuck up on me. We're only after the fact that I realized that was kind of going on. Past that, I think that, you know, his usual collaborators, such as cinematographer Sean Price Williams and editor Robert Greene, are doing some of their best work. I think it's a beautifully edited film, for one thing, the way that it oscillates back and forth between
the
past and present. There's one match cut in particular that involves a door closing that I thought was just really stunning. It's the kind of thing that you might not even notice unless you're just kind of attuned to something at that particular moment. But when it happened, I just kind of thought, you know, it's the sort of thing that the movie doesn't really need to do at that point, and yet it still does. It still makes the effort of putting this forth. And the fact that it does, I think, is telling of a complexity that's going on in this movie. You know, sort of the fact that Catherine Washington's character could very well be this complete villain, this completely horrible person, or she might not be. You know, the movie doesn't announce itself very clearly as having intentions in either direction. So I like this movie quite a bit. It's funny because I don't like it as much as Listen Up, Philip. I would say it's maybe on par with The Color Wheel, although comparing them is, I don't know how you compare them, really. It's like comparing, you know, it's like comparing soup and a tomato. Soup and steak?
No, it's soup and tomato is probably better.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on the soup.
You need some better.
We need to hire a punch-up writer for
Apple
Nick.
And orange is not good enough for you?
Apples and oranges is overused, but anyway.
What about, like, soup and a wheelbarrow?
Well, I have to... It should be food.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that you were doing that.
A meteorite and a weasel.
So anyhow, I liked Queen of Earth a lot. It's a good motion picture. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Amanda, what did you think of Queen of Earth?
So when this film started, it's really gripped me. The opening shot, as many, well, the opening scene, as many people have pointed out, and many reviews have pointed out, is this very affecting scene, this tight, tight, tight close-up of Elizabeth Moss's face as the character Catherine, and it is just mascara streaked, and she's crying, and she's talking to her very disaffected boyfriend who's off screen.
Name of and James. It's
James.
Played by James, Kentucker Aldley.
Yeah,
that's very... not a name.
His name is Kentucker.
Kentucker Aldley. Yeah. That's a real guy.
Terrible. No, that's unfair.
He's a handsome guy. No?
Anyway. And when I think the reason that it drew me in was because there was a sense of camp to it. And I thought, because if there was any image, like if there was a tragedy comedy mask for camp, it would be a woman's mascara streaked face. It is just so over the top and so suggestive. And I thought,
and the title card too is like,
and the title card. And I actually think this is the case where this film's promotional materials maybe were overshadowed this film a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know why that trailer is that trailer.
I didn't watch the trailer. I wanted to be surprised.
I love the trailer. I love the posters.
I only saw the posters after I saw the movie.
Yeah, there's something very exploitative about it, which I enjoy. But then when you actually go into the film, you know, and there are things about it where I, you know, from that opening shot, I thought, oh, this is going to be this like campy, over the top, you know, almost like soap opera-y. I don't even know how to describe it. Like, because there are moments where it just feels like almost like a woman's film, like where you have these. I almost would compare it to maybe like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford.
I was going to say Now Voyager.
Yeah, where it's just these women just being complete bitches to each other, and there's a very diva-ish aspect to it. And there's I will say, even visually, like there's one scene where it's supposed to take place the previous summer, and Kevin Waterston's character Jenny is wearing these huge sunglasses that look like something like Marlena Dietrich would wear, and Catherine, Elizabeth Moss's character, is wearing this bright red lipstick, and they just look, and they're just sitting there trading barbs, and it's just so, like, it's just like something out of like Valley of the Dolls, or just something so like just over the top, just, you know, like claws out, you know, I don't even know. It's just really interesting, but at the same time, I think people are misreading this film. And it really bothers me. There's one particular... this is the kind of movie that really brings out the snooty side of critics to a degree where when I was like reading reviews, I just kept saying, go fuck yourself, like anytime somebody... there's one in particular. There's a Playlist review that said that this film really presents complicated female dynamics. And also, it's what called did they,
was this person plucked out of a subreddit? Like, R Red Pill?
It's like, oh, I'm sorry. Is Alex Ross Perry Margaret Atwood now? Yeah. And also, it said it's a little too obscure for some audiences, which, anyway, like I said, I just feel like this is the kind of
movie the dumb like, classes won't like it.
It's like, you remedials.
The intellectual underclass may not, you know, be hip to its jive.
Yeah, I think that's what bothers me. And there's just so many things about this film where it is very much, I would almost call it a, like, to compare it with Listen Up, Philip, I think in terms of like sexual politics is appropriate, because I think with Listen Up, Philip, it's this idea that this privileged white male, his just arrogance, like his just complete like overconfidence is what shields him from reality. Whereas this film is basically like, white privileged women do not have that luxury. They basically have no shield because men are their shield. You know, you have to and you're thinking about, you know, Catherine is having a breakdown because her father died, possibly of a suicide. There's like some suggestions of it. And because her boyfriend broke up with her, and there's so many suggestions of like, oh, you know, she was codependent on him. And that, of course, is another thing where she and Ginny sort of like trade barbs because Ginny doesn't like that they're so codependent. But there's something about it where there's so many times, there's so many readings of this film as being haunting or being terrifying or thrilling that I don't really get.
Yeah.
Partly because the way I read this was, it really plays on our expectations of movies like this. And there's so many moments where there's like a Chekhov's gun thing where there's one toward the end where you see as Ginny's like sort of in the throes of her mental break, or not Ginny, Catherine's like in the throes of her breakdown. She's sharpening a pencil because during the entire trip, she's sketching this portrait of Ginny, and she's sharpening a pencil, and Patrick Fugit comes in her room. And like you said, Nick, there is a certain of intrusive quality about him. And it's almost, it's like on a level of like Streetcar Named Desire where she just cannot handle his, she just can't handle him being around. And you think first, it's leading you, I think it's building up and building up to you thinking that she's going to do something to herself or do something to him. And she's sharpening this pencil, and it makes it a point of showing her sharpening this pencil. And then Patrick Fugit comes into her room, and you think, you're convinced that she's going to stab him with this pencil. And there's also a scene where after she delivers this amazing, again, like just totally like Betty Davis claws out, just attack on Patrick Fugit, just calling him a worthless piece of shit. After she delivers it, Ginny like covers up this knife, like as if...
Was it a knife? It looked like a bowl of salad.
She, yeah, it's like a knife sitting on a plate, and she just covers it up real quick as
I thought she was just really nervous that that salad was going to get thrown.
Oh, also, there's lots of cups being thrown.
Again, the moment of silence for the amount of cups that died in the making of this film.
Beautiful. All the china.
More
Why?
Cups died in this film than horses died filming Luck.
Oh.
That's an obscure Luck joke, I guess, I was just waiting to make.
But, yeah, so she covers up this knife as if she's expecting Catherine to stab someone. And I kept thinking, like, I did not feel as if anyone was in danger during the whole course of this film. And I think that that is sort of, there's something about this film that is sort of implicating the viewer on how not only do you like watching women fall apart in films, but also you, how much you enjoy it and how there's this expectation of cinema, because there's, this has been going on for so long, and there's so many sort of like hysterical woman films where it usually does culminate in someone dying at the hands of this female protagonist, and it never happens. So I think it's playing on those expectations and also sort of saying like, shame on you for wanting her to do this in a way. I don't know. Maybe that's overreading it a little bit, but I think that's part of me felt like that was kind of what he was reaching for. But it is, I don't know. I think there's just so much about this film that I think he was just reaching for something. I just left me so cold and just so... I didn't think it was funny, even though some people apparently thought it was funny. I didn't think it was horrifying, even though some people thought it was horrifying. And I see the subjective quality of it. I see... But, like, Moss's performance toward the end is so over-the-top cartoony. It's almost like how you would play a crazy woman in, like, a high school play. Just like whispering to yourself and like laughing to yourself and being, and I think that is the, I think that that was on purpose, but I also just didn't care. I also just really found this film to be, I think, so, to just like be, it's just so overreaching. And I just didn't think it looked good. And there were so many times.
Oh my God, thank you.
It just
if I have to read one more review about what a good looking film this is, I'm gonna fucking kill someone.
It looked like garbage, and it was
awful, and different varying levels of awful.
Well, and the thing was,
different
of it too,
kinds
is that,
of awful.
Yeah, and it's shot on 16mm, and it looks like it was shot on 16mm. And there are so many moments where it's so low tech, and there's so many arty like lens flares and like frames being bleached out by the sunlight. But then there would be these like super stylized shots. Like I think there's a shot of Ginny as Catherine's drawing her, and it's the split diopter.
Yeah.
Shot, which is just so like, why are you doing this? It's just so distracting because the rest of the film is just, like I said, it's just so low tech, just so bare bones, you know, meant to look kind of rough and retro. And I don't know, it just really didn't do it for me. And I think it was just, it really, this movie would not pass the Bechdel test, also. Not that I give any credence to that standard, because I think it's a flawed test, but I think it's just, there's just so many things where he's really just overdoing so many things that I'm really not sure what he's trying to do. And it also, I just, like I said, I just don't care. And I just, there's something in me too, maybe it's just me personally, I just have such a pet peeve with when you're writing a character and the only motivation you can give them is that they're crazy. They're crazy. That's why they're doing what they're doing. They're just, you know, and it is just like, I just hate that. I just hate that, like, oh, there's no, the only reason this woman would be doing these things, there's no rational reason for it. There's no practical reason for it. It's just that she's crazy. And I think that...
Well, all women are inherently crazy, are they not, Amanda?
Oh, my God, for sure. I mean, as this movie...
You're just waiting for a little push to let out your latent insanity.
Well, that's the other thing, too, is that...
And you're a horrible bitch to all of your friends.
I'm a super horrible bitch, exactly. And it's just, like, that's the thing about this movie where it's, like I said about that playlist review, is talking about how, oh, this really accurately depicts, like, complicated female dynamics, where it's just, like... What? Like... How is this? This is accurate? This is how people are reading this film? Because also, this film, the whole thing is it too, is that people are saying, oh, you know, it's about this, the erosion of this friendship. This movie never really sets up this friendship very well.
Yeah, that's asinine. It's like looking at a still photograph of a flaming house and saying this really shows the slow consumption of this building by fire.
But it is, it's like oh, you know, last year it was Ginny was the one having the problems and Catherine was the one who was stable, and now it's Catherine is the one having this breakdown and Ginny is the one who's stable. And like, I never got the sense that they were good friends. I was like, these women fucking hate each other, and they always have hated each other. And yeah, then there's that scene,
Amanda,
at the end where
I'm sorry,
it's like they
did you
hug
not
each
know
other.
That women can never be friends with each other?
It is ridiculous.
Did you never see a stand-up comic in the 90s to know that women are never actually friends?
And I honestly, and like I said before, I don't think that that is what he's doing. I really don't think that he is trying to accurately depict, like,
yeah, it sounds like you're mad at the review.
I'm mad. I'm sort of mad at how people are reading this film, honestly.
But how else are you supposed to read it? You know, it's like a boggle board, or like when people just spill a whole bag of Scrabble tiles on the floor. Like, there's no cohesive narrative. Sure, it's in English. You know that those are English letters.
Well,
but there's no like solid words plotted out. I'm not going to critique the plot of a goddamn spilled bag of Scrabble tiles. But you know what I also won't do is claim that it's a novel with a cohesive theme. Which is what people are doing to this movie.
Well, no, like I said before, I do think it is him commenting on how cinema has for so long sort of played on this, you know, this image of like the hysterical woman. And like, there are so many hysterical woman films. And there are just so many movies that depict women as like I said, their only motivation is like, they're going crazy. These crazy women, look at them. Like, and I do think that he is commenting on it. I don't think that it works. I understand what he was going for, and I'm fine with it. But I just really don't understand why people are reading it as like, oh, it's these women and they have a friendship and it's falling apart. What the fuck are you talking about? Like, these women are like, they're just like, there's a non-relationship there, basically. And they're just, and like you said, it's like subjective. And you feel as though like it's this sense of like really being alone in a world and not really having any friendships and not really having any relationships with people. But I just think it's like you're just reaching for so much at that point. And like, how can you possibly do that? Yeah.
Because I think just, the movie, because I assume you're talking to me. Cause these
no,
are all
no, no. I'm not talking to you, Nick. I'm just talking in
but
general.
These are literally all things I've said. So no. It's just I think the movie does exhibit a subjective quality. And I do think on the subject of... I do think on the subject of the friendship, I mean, it's worth noting that this is basically sifting through wreckage. That's what the movie really is. It's kind of like, you know, Brian says something about a burning house or something.
Yeah.
This is basically the house after it's burned. And I do think it's worth noting, I mean, even though this is kind of, maybe this seems like a weird note, I mean, there are times when you know, you're aware that your friendship with somebody is over, but you're still communicating with them, and you're still... I also think it's important that there is the implication that they have not gotten along for a while, and that things have not been great with them for a while, as the flashbacks will show. And considering what the opening scene of this movie is, considering the only point when she is by herself, really, or rather when she's not with her friend... there is kind of this thing of, well, perhaps she's going to go back to them because she thinks that they will be able to provide help and she can overlook the problems that they already have. But then once they're actually together, it doesn't pan out. And I think that I think there are scenarios in the film. I think there are lines of dialogue that prove this point, particularly with the boyfriend. The fact that he is present at all is a sign that there's not really much agreement there and that the whole thing was a bad idea. So I don't know. I mean, I think that
And I think on that note, I think Catherine does see Ginny as her sort of last resort. I think she does see her as sort of like her lifesaver. And when she doesn't fulfill that role entirely, that's when she really kind of falls apart.
For me, it's not, you know, if you want to talk about, you know, female friendship or something, this isn't exactly an episode of, you know, Sex and the City, where the previous episode they're all friends and they're getting along. Because if you were to watch like an episode of Sex and the City, if like this was an episode of it, first of all, you'd have a lot of questions about what happened to the show, but secondly, you think to yourself like, wait, this doesn't make sense, because the previous episode they were, you know, getting cocktails and talking about their boyfriends or something. This isn't that.
No, it's not. No. And I'm not expecting it to be that. Like I said, I went into it thinking like it was going to be like just complete like camp. Like it was just going to be like an episode of Dynasty almost. But there's just something about this film. It's just so incredibly mealy-mouthed. And it's very mealy-mouthed. It's very like everyone's just talking in whispers and it's just like these little... Everyone's just like, oh, I'm so sorry about your dad. Oh, I know. Like, it's just frustrating to watch. It's very annoying. I grew very impatient with this film. And there's a really odd scene. And if you're going to talk about like how this film is subjective, I think we need to talk about the super bizarre, almost like Eyes Wide Shut level, like party scene where people just basically... Which is just like, which just culminates in like people like literally just poking at her.
Yeah, that's the one scene in the movie I just feel like I feel like it really got away from him. I feel like that scene doesn't work at all. And I think that what it's trying to putting you in her headspace, what she's feeling, I think the problem is that it's so obviously that. There's no question that is what she is feeling. But the sequence itself is... It feels like a very obvious tactic of having basically, you know, it's kind of like in the original Dawn of the Dead when the elevator opens up and all the zombies rush at the camera. It's basically that. And it doesn't,
well,
it
and
doesn't
it's
really
also,
land.
No, it doesn't land. And I think, too, if you're going to talk about like, okay, so this is her subjective you know, this is a very subjective film, but it's also, you know, she's very outwardly showing or demonstrating that she is losing it. So do we really need to have these over the top subjective moments if we're also going to, like, in conjunction with these displays of just like,
how many cups does a crazy person have to throw before they are truly crazy?
Yeah. And I think that's what it is to me, is it's like,
this is a legitimate question.
How many cups?
Yeah. Oh, I'm asking,
well,
for a friend.
Are we going by, like, I haven't taken a psychology course.
Because if, as this movie posits, it is two. Oh my god, I can't believe the cat is back on my fucking desk again. Anyway.
You just shut a door or something.
the door is shut. It doesn't latch all the way. Okay, we're fine. It's on the bookshelf now. Okay. Yeah, this movie posits that two cups may be enough to determine someone is crazy.
Yeah, and like, I can understand. And like I said before, I think obviously I'm getting hysterical.
Well, you're a woman. That's what you do.
I'm a woman. That's what I do. You know, ovaries and shit. Yeah. And I think obviously I'm being more affected by like people's readings of it than the film itself. The film itself, like I said, it just kind of left me cold. I can understand, like Nick, I can understand your reading of it. I appreciate it. I think I just, you know, it's just one of those things where like, I didn't enjoy it. I didn't enjoy watching it. I would have appreciated a little bit of subtlety. So yeah, I think that is just like, I just didn't enjoy it in general.
Okay, well, I hated this film. I'm never watching another Alex Ross Perry film again. This was what I thought was the greatest loss of 2 hours in my entire life until I realized that the movie was actually only 90 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
This was an interminable, unpleasant, ugly, indecipherable, just awful, one-dimensional, screeching harpy of a film. And going on to Rotten Tomatoes and seeing that it has 96%, and having read the Film Stage review and the RogerEbert.com review and numerous other reviews, once again makes me think that people who think that critics are a culturally elite ruling class of intellectuals who are so scared of realizing that, like, or being left behind, that they're willing to praise garbage if they think someone smarter than them is going to praise it too, that's probably true, because there's no other way to describe why this movie is being praised like it is. Why,
well,
people are drawing from parishes. Like, this is an awful film.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the character of Pulp's Common People.
I mean, just for God's sakes, like, the well, we've already talked about how ugly the film looks, and not intentionally ugly like a grindhouse film, but the type of ugly you can only get if you are attempting to do something interesting and you realize that, like, your script is bullshit, so maybe you ought to, like, make it look good. So it's this weird amalgamation of, like, I guess we're trying too hard, or maybe we're not trying hard enough, or maybe we're trying too hard to make it look like we're not trying. And the editing is fine. I will give it its editing. I did find the editing to be great. So if this were a silent film, maybe that would work. But we have two very capable actresses who appear to be giving their all to a void of a script that on no planet could be seen to have a convincing theme. And the music is good, but it's like if you put the Jaws theme over a guy eating a tuna sandwich. There's no friggin' point to it. There's no point to it. There's no point to having it probably would be better without the music. Because the music is consistently saying, something's happening. Something's gonna happen, and nothing ever does. And at least if the music wasn't there, I'd be like, oh, this is just an incredibly bland, overacted insight into two shitty people's shitty relationship. But the music keeps being like, ooh, old-time psychological thriller music. This is some deep shit happening. And it's not. It's not. It's awful. It's two horrible people being horrible to each other, continuing to interact in ways that make no goddamn sense to any human being in the world. And then they have other people coming into their lives every now and then who continue to not react like human beings. And it's just an endless supply of the most unstimulating failure that I've seen on film since I don't even know when.
So,
I don't know that I can ever trust anyone who ever says they like this film. I don't know that I can even believe
that they do.
Seriously can't. There's nothing in me. Like, if I have a friend who says, like, oh, I really like Transformers, I'll go, like, I can understand why, because you're just looking for dumb fun, and maybe
this isn't Boondock Saints, Brian. I mean, come on.
Boondock Saints is fucking The Last Temptation of Christ compared to this film. Boondock Saints has a story you can follow. It has characters who, once you've established their character, continue to do things that are in character. That character's insane. That character's batshit crazy. That character's the kind of conservative power fantasy that would make Rush Limbaugh come, but at least it's consistent. And this film is just a waking nightmare. And you know what? It starts off with a title card and then says Saturday. And I was like, oh, okay, so they're going to be
and
there for a weekend.
Beautiful script.
Oh, yeah, the script is
beautiful.
Great.
Script.
Again, an affectation that means nothing and signifies nothing and leads to nothing. And it says Saturday, and I'm like, okay, probably like Saturday and Sunday, like it's a weekend thing. And then it said Monday, and I'm like, great, maybe it's Memorial Day. And then when it said Tuesday, I nearly lost my goddamn mind, because I was like, if I have to spend
Are you just looking
week,
for things to be mad about? I don't understand what point you're making here.
Because the movie is interminable, and it's just awful. And I'm telling you that as I began to realize exactly how much time I was going to have to spend in this film, I grew more and more desperate to get out. Like, this is the type of film that, looking at the critical consensus around it, it just kind of makes me think, like, yeah, I'm in the wrong industry. Obviously, I'm not a movie critic. Obviously, I shouldn't be looking at movies, because if this is good, then I must be a lizard. I don't know. There's nothing here. There's nothing here. And to hear people defend it, and to see people claim that it's brilliant, to see my own website call it one of the best of the year, is shocking and baffling, and I can't accept it. I can't. There must be something wrong with me, or wrong with the whole rest of the world. Maybe I'm going through an Elizabeth Moss like breakdown, and this is my party where people are poking
me
while there's a reflective light in my face. Like, I don't know, but this movie is awful. Yeah. No one should see it, and anyone who tells you to see it probably isn't your friend.
Wow.
And I just, like, that's it. Like, I didn't even want to do this podcast. I literally wanted to come on and say, it's a bad movie, don't see it. That's my opinion. But then I realized, like, oh, I should probably go into why I feel that way. And it's hard to explain why, because it's just in my eyes, bad. It's like, oh, why is that car that has no wheels and is on fire not a good way to drive from New York to LA? Because it's not. Because obviously it's not. Why isn't this a good movie? Because did you see it?
Oh my God.
It's bad. It's bad in every way a movie can be bad. And it's made worse by the fact that the people who made it thought they were doing something good and important. And the people who watched it and reviewed it for a living validated that distinction in their heads.
Mm-hmm. You know, generally elevating yourself above others who have seen it is not really a good critical practice. But since you are apparently now in a state that is superior to film criticism, I suppose I can't fault you for that. Nevertheless,
I'm saying I'm below film criticism, apparently.
Well,
I should just end this podcast and just do nothing but watch Michael Bay films now, because obviously I'm not smart enough to get Queen of Earth.
So, Danny, how was your weekend? We should just let these two go at it.
I know people who dislike this movie, but they didn't take quite that approach to it.
I think to get so upset over this film is giving it more power.
But that's like the only power that I had a very interesting conversation, actually, with a critic friend of mine over which film had the more detestable, unlikable, and frankly nonsensical protagonist. Because we both didn't like Queen of Earth and Listen Up, Philip, for different reasons. And we actually had a great conversation about whether Philip was the worst character or these two women were worse characters. And we had different opinions. So, like, I can't deny that there is some critical debate to be had, but it's just related to who is worse in terms of characters created in film.
And actually, the more you talk about it, the more it makes me think of a film that I just recently reviewed called Fort Tilden, which is also about two women.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Being awful all the time. Maybe part of me is just sick of seeing two. And I, like I said, the whole Bechdel test, I think one of the reasons I brought in the whole Bechdel test thing is just like, can we just make a movie about two women who are just friends and are cool and are hanging out and it's all good? And
not to be so pedantic here, but this movie literally would pass the Bechdel test.
It would not. All they do is talk about men in this movie. All they fucking do in this movie is talk about
men. But the rule is that there has to be one point where they do not specifically talk about men. And there are instances where that is the case.
But it's constantly her being like...
It's kind of like the one drop rule. You know, it's like...
Well, like I said again, I don't give credence to that rule. I don't at all. I think it's super flawed. I don't. Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
Well, because gravity wouldn't pass the Bechdel test.
Gravity?
Gravity would not pass the Bechdel test.
No, because there's not another woman.
There's not another woman.
Yeah.
But that's not saying that's not a movie that is like female positive and a good depiction of women.
Well, and it is like, but I think I almost would say that, and I'm not going to give Perry, you know, this much credit, but part of me almost wonders if this is like an anti-Bechdel test movie. like, hey, you guys have this completely arbitrary rule. This is what it is, Rot. I don't know. I'm not going to give it that much credit, but it is, I think I'm just kind of tired of seeing these movies where it's just like these two women being horrible, and at least make it entertaining. At least make it like worth, like I said, I brought up Valley of the Dolls earlier. Valley of the Dolls is just women being horrific to each other, but it is so fun to watch. And it's like, I don't know. And I think it almost has more to say than this movie does about anything. I don't know. It's just, like I said before, it's just a mealy-mouthed, frustrating film that I just did not enjoy watching.
Yeah, that's basically what I said.
Yeah. Oh, I think you said more, Brian.
Probably. Honestly, I blacked out. I don't remember even saying anything.
The idea that what Brian said kind of bothers me, the idea that nothing happens in the movie is odd, because I just feel like that's objectively not true.
Like, what happens?
True. What happens? Like, do you want me to just
discuss any random scene? What incident occurs that matters in the film? Like,
the various...
I'm sitting in a room right now, and if I wasn't talking to you guys, things would still be happening. I would be sitting here. That's something that's happening. Above me, a dog might be wandering around. That's happening. Are these going to form my life? Would I tell them to someone if they called me and asked what I was doing? No. Because they're not important. Because they're not impactful. Because they're not forming the narrative of my life in this instant. In this movie, people like throw fucking cups at each other and just never talk about it. And Elizabeth Moss's character, Catherine, has this... admittedly begins great and then goes on so long that it becomes laughably stupid tirade about why she hates Patrick Fugit's character. And sure, that counts as something happening, but and then he just comes up and talks to her again. And then she debases herself. And then her friend just comes in the next morning and the room is made up and it's clean and it looks like no one's ever been there except for like a 5-year-old's drawing that was left behind. And it's just, but it doesn't matter. There's no lasting impact.
Okay. But here's the thing. Here's where I really take objection. First of all, you just described things that do happen.
But
so things do happen in the survey.
Anything.
But also, no. But hold on. I want to break this down point by point. Also, the idea that this is entirely a verbal film that you know, there's just, because they don't say anything, that means it doesn't count. I mean, there are hundreds of great movies that are about glances and gestures, that are about the physical movements that somebody makes that communicate something, where you can intuit something based on real life experience, where you can look at it and you can say, this is like something that would happen in real life.
But these,
this is like something
that
I've seen. But the thing is, not to get too personal with this, but I have had experiences similar to what is going on in this movie. And when I was watching this film, I was reminded of specific incidents involving people where I was present, and the movie captures that kind of feeling very well. The feeling where you don't say anything, where you just sort of let something play out, and then you let something settle, and then you wait to see how it's going to happen, which is exactly the case with Patrick Fugit's character. I mean, because that's one of my favorite things
I disagree.
This is one of my favorite things that a movie can do, though. It's one of my favorite things that a movie can do, is to have an incident occur, and then to not directly state that it has happened or that it affects the people, and then to just let the scenario play out. Because in real life, it is not out of the question that he would go into her room and try to act like nothing happened. That happens plenty of times. For God's sake, I just graduated
Why
from college. This is the kind of thing that people my age do all the time. Why does he? I don't know. The movie's not about him, but it infers that this is something that he does in his personality. The movie doesn't feel the need to go into his personality piece by piece to explain why he handles the situation this way. But considering the fact that he knows she's mentally troubled, he knows that his girlfriend's best friend is in this state, perhaps behind closed doors, such as in that great match cut when the door is closed, he was told something about a certain way to behave. I can't say for certain, but I don't need the movie to tell me because I'm not a child. Like, that's the thing. I don't need the movie to tell me everything that is going on because otherwise it'd be stupid. I mean, just the idea that nothing happens in the movie really bothers me because I feel like that goes against so much of what I personally value in movies, which is just that there are all these things occurring.
There's a difference between people acting as though nothing has happened for the sake of keeping a peace, and people just it literally is like a sitcom where every scene is the start of the new episode where no one makes mention of the fact that yesterday George Clooney was the guest star. Like, no one says, hey, wasn't it crazy when Monica got locked on the roof? No, they're just like, okay, you know what the score is. These two broads are nuts, and this guy likes to stir the pot and go. There's not a continuum.
No, I think there is
no
continuum. But I think
I can appreciate what you're talking about because I like the same thing in movies. This didn't give it to me, which is why it's frustrating. Because at the first,
okay, it didn't give it to you. But the problem is that you're acting as if because it didn't give it to you, it does not present it at all ever.
I don't
to anybody
that it does.
But
and
you
I
don't believe that it does.
Reading,
but you,
I would just say like it feels like you're reading into it. And like giving
reading
it
into
meaning
it is
that,
not what you're supposed to do with a movie.
No, I'm not saying reading into it like, oh, well, this dress is red and that symbolizes blah. You're like, oh, well, this there's nothing there, so I can put into it what I would like.
I don't know.
Feel like, you know, the emperor has no clothes, but no one wants to admit it. So they're just like, okay.
Don't use that critical.
Well, I didn't want to, but you didn't seem to be getting what I was saying.
No, I got exactly what you were saying, and then you use the most tired, just unevocative critical term that is available.
Well, when was
the emperor
time
has
you
no
heard
clothes.
Someone use the emperor has no clothes?
Man, this is some heard? Like Ebert Siskel level shit going on.
I think it was.
Love it.
I, you know what? There is a certain critic who I dislike very much who used that term recently, and when I read it, I thought, of course they use that term. I'm not going to say who it is, just because.
Dude, I said playlist earlier. Just say it.
It's not important.
Well, again, I didn't want to say it, but I couldn't come up with a better thing, and it honestly seemed to me like you didn't get what I was trying to say.
I got exactly what you were saying from the word go.
Now that I know that, I will. How about I bleep out that then?
Well, what's strange is
keep
that?
It. So, keep it.
All right, I'll keep it.
It was said. It was put into the ether. Let it exist in the ether.
Okay. You know, the ether's got to have something to exist in it.
You can't put toothpaste back in a tube. You know,
you know how often I've wanted to try
just to say,
like, take a video just so that when someone says that I could show them the video.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it would involve a lot of other contraptions, but it's
one possible. One last thing I'm going to say is that you talk about how there's no progression between them. But personally, I found the final shot of this movie very surprising and very disturbing, because there is this... I think that Moss's performance, I mean, I seem to like it more than most other people on the show, but to me there's something kind of apocalyptic about it. There is kind of the sense of an actual... There is the sense of, like, an actual destruction. Like, something is actually breaking at that moment in her performance, okay, in the radiation of it. And the last shot, which is a freeze frame, I remember sitting in the theater and just kind of almost jolting a bit when the freeze frame came up, and then I realized that it was the end.
Because, you're very skittish, Nick.
Because the thing about it is that the expression that it freezes on to me is perfect, because it is either this moment of freedom or imprisonment. And the fact that the movie doesn't give it to you either way, it doesn't explicitly state either way what it is, and it could so easily be either. And it also, in a way, I mean, sort of the narcissism of the movie's title, Queen of Earth, is, I think, perfectly exhibited in that. We're at the end, again, like at the beginning, but not even at the beginning, because there's virtually nobody around. She is just herself. It is just her there, and there's something... Again, there's something sort of apocalyptic about that final image, where that is the end. That is almost like the end of the world inside that single shot. Just her laughing, either in madness or in freedom. And it felt to me like a culmination.
Well, the difference between you and I, Nick, is maybe that I felt that the movie was trying and failing to do that, and you let the movie succeed.
The movie succeed is an interesting way to word it, but...
All right. Well, I actually think that that point kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about how it plays in our expectations of these types of movies. Whereas the expectation is that she is going to destroy herself. Like, she, whether it's by killing herself or by hurting someone and being physically incarcerated, however you want to pursue that. Whereas in this case, it's just, she's just going to go on. She's just going to, and you're not really sure whether or not she's ever going to be, like, I don't know, maybe fully functional. It's just, she's just going to keep going. It's not really like, look, you want her to end. She's not going to end. She's just going to keep existing. And I think that's kind of what the ending was saying, was that she's like, you... Just because women have, like, or just because these female characters, whatever they represent, you know. All right, I got to collect my thoughts here for a second. Yeah, sorry. You guys just had, like, such an insane argument that I think I did, like. But it is, I think it is just, like I said before, you said it's, whether it's freedom or imprisonment. I don't think it really matters. It's just that, hey, she's not going anywhere, guys. Like, deal with it, I think is what the film is saying.
And then sunglasses fall down on her face.
you know the
meme, oh, like, deal with it?
You come a long way, ladies. Yeah, and I think... I guess I could see... But like I said before, that's not enough for me.
Yeah, this movie felt like someone with $12 got inspired by, like, Melancholia or Antichrist and then tried to make a movie that was like that with his friends but didn't get any of the subtlety or nuance that allowed those movies to exist in that way emotionally.
This more than Melancholia and Antichrist.
That is insane.
I've never seen Melancholia. I don't want to watch Antichrist. I just don't want to.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, Danny, do you have anything to say? Are you still here?
Danny.
I'm enjoying the show.
Danny is our literal audience surrogate.
Yeah. The only thing I would add is, like, some of what Nick was saying about Elizabeth Moss and her state of mind at the end. I did find that very creepy. And
because you're a man.
But did you find it creepy or no?
It's scary to think that crazy women really do exist. I don't know.
I just found that I laughed.
That's not really what I meant.
I know, I'm just joking. Okay. I'm just joking.
Amanda, Danny's really concerned that you might think he's a misogynist.
Yeah. No, I'm not. Go ahead. Sorry, Danny.
No, I was going to say, I like the word Nick used, apocalyptic, because earlier I was going to say in that opening shot, she almost looks like a monster, kind of. And I sort of like the feeling that Amanda's been talking about, where basically, like, for the last half hour of the movie, every scene feels like it could end with someone just being killed, and like it never happens. And I love that feeling of unease.
After a while, I actually got really tired of that. Because okay. I was like, I kept
just
saying,
never felt uneasy. Never felt that.
Well, I never felt the unease. I kept feeling the, something's going to happen.
Yeah.
Something's going to happen. And then nothing kept happening. Sorry, Nick. And it just, when it didn't happen for long enough, I stopped caring.
Yeah. I don't know, but I do like Amanda said, like, she could forgive some of this stuff if she found it entertaining, I guess, but I found it really entertaining. It seems like I don't get the arguments that the movie doesn't look good. I mean, all the shots of the water were, I thought they were captivating.
Some of the exterior shots look fine. I wouldn't say it's a work of visual brilliance by any means. I mean, I just thought it looked cruddy. And I know that was the effect, but I don't.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you not like 16 millimeter? I'm curious when you said you said disparagingly it looks like 16 millimeter, and I kind of went, ooh.
No, there are 16, but I think it's just the point that, like, he chose 16 millimeter for a specific reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it is to sort of capture this this retro, you know, this idea of, I mean, everybody keeps comparing it to, like, Bergman, and everybody keeps comparing it to Cassavetes. And I think the Cassavetes thing most certainly applies here, where it's like he really wanted it to look like a certain type of movie. And I get that, but it looks like garbage. I don't know. I just don't think it looks... That doesn't mean that, like... And like I said before, he has this, like, certain look, but then he has these, like, much more stylized shots where it's just like, well, if you are able to do that, it just doesn't fit. I don't know. To me, it just, like, does not fit with the tone. I mean, I think the visual tone of the film. Like, if you're going to show off along with like also having this like completely like non-showy format, I don't know. Like, it just doesn't jibe with me.
It's worth noting that I don't know if this comment is worth anything, but it might be worth noting that all of his movies have been shot in 16 millimeter. So obviously it's something.
No, I agree.
Better than this film.
But listen up, Philip, I think when you have a film that's like, especially when you're doing outdoor shots, especially when it's a lot of like natural lighting, it just makes it far more glaring. With Listen Up, Philip, obviously that takes place in, there's a lot more interior shots. There's a lot more, you know, there's very few outdoor scenes in Listen Up, Philip. And in this one, there's so many, and there's so many sequences where it's outside that I think it is just too much, much, much more noticeable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah. I'm not saying that too.
Made me feel like I liked Listen Up, Philip.
I liked Listen Up,
Philip. Is that weird?
I should add that. I actually really enjoyed Listen Up, Philip. I think Listen Up, Philip had a much more clear agenda.
Right, exactly.
And I liked it. I liked what it was going for. I didn't like what this movie was going for.
I should say that my noting his, you know, 16mm fetishism, just as a, if listeners aren't aware, I think it might go with what you're saying, if anything else, just that it's like he just loves the format so much that no matter what he's going to shoot in it, which ultimately
could be a limiting factor.
Yeah, again. It
is, and I think it might have even been super 16 millimeter. I can't remember if it was super 16 or just 16, because there are movies that have been shot in 16 millimeter that I really like. But I think, like I said before, it is, or I don't know if it was Brian or Nick pointed out, it is very limiting. And if you're going to shoot, have so many outdoor shots, you might want to, I don't know, you might want to reconsider a little bit, like, what you're doing. I don't know. I think just on a technical level, it just didn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Right, well,
as somebody who has shot with 16mm, it's not an easy format. It really isn't. And I appreciate, you know, and I appreciate that. And I appreciate, like, shooting anything in, like, non-digital. But it's, you know, it's just, yeah, it just didn't do it for me.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've been talking.
I think
for
the sort of the heart.
I'm sorry, Danny.
I think the harsh light. This, I was going to make a joke.
No.
No, just I was going to say, I think the harsh light it reflects on female relationships.
Right. He's shining a light on the female relationship truths that have been kept in the dark by the patriarchy.
Can I just point out one more thing that just made me there was another review, I think it was, I can't remember what it was, but somebody described the film as being fraught with neurotic diaphanous riddles.
Said that?
Fuck you.
Diaphoric. Jesus Christ.
So diaphanous riddles?
Not have surprised me if this movie ended like The Color Wheel ended.
Oh, shit.
The Color
Where these two... I guess I won't spoil it then.
Yeah, don't spoil
it, please. I need to watch it. Well, actually, no, spoil it.
You don't want that spoiled.
Yeah, you don't want that spoiled.
Really? I don't? Okay. Well, then don't spoil it.
Hey, Nick, it's been out for like 3 years. I mean, like, there's no such thing as spoiling it, right?
Right.
It's not exactly like Citizen Kane. It's not Rosebud. It's not like people are, or like The Crying Game. It's not like people are talking about it. No? Did I miss something?
Oh, no, I just meant that it's like,
it's actually exactly like Citizen Kane.
It's like it's like the movie's a puzzle film, and then it ends with them finding the clue.
Well, that's why it's called The Color Wheel, is because each scene is shot with a different single color. So first it's like black and white, and then it's blue and white, and then when you put them all together and overlay them over themselves, it creates the one true tapestry.
Wait, are you fucking with me, Brian?
I'm totally fucking with you.
Oh my god. I don't know, after watching this movie, kind of like, it could be a possibility. Right. I'll watch it.
I'm glad that some people continue to like this man's work, but I'm out. I'm checked out.
You're peacing out.
Yeah, I'm done. There's no point. There's no point to me watching another one of his films because I'm just not gonna like it.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Like, and I can't even like trust critical consensus to guide my opinion.
Yes, yes, we know, Brian. We know.
So I just like, I'm done. I can't. Like, people kept saying, "Ooh, this is the one you'll like. Maybe you'll like this one."
No.
And they were wrong, and they were utterly wrong, and they're wrong in a way that makes me feel like Listen Up, Philip was a good movie, which is bananas, but maybe I'll go back and watch that, because maybe I will like it now.
I thought Listen Up, Philip was hilarious.
Listen Up, Philip was the closest I ever got to liking an Alex Ross Perry film, because I could tell what he was doing, I could tell he was doing it well, but for some reason I still didn't like it.
Yeah.
I remember you hating it.
I hated it. I hated it a lot. But at least that, I was like, oh, that guy's a dick. I know why he's a dick. I know why he's going to continue to be a dick.
Brian, what are you going to do when the Winnie the Pooh movie comes out?
I don't know. Someone told me about that today, and I lost my mind.
Wait, you didn't remember that news?
No, I
That's a weird bit
out.
Of news.
It's the strangest.
He's adapting a DeLillo book, too.
Is he?
Yeah.
Which one?
The Names.
Okay, the Names. That one. Yeah.
I wonder if it's going to be like Kubrick. Like, for me, when Kubrick was just doing, I don't know, I think his adaptations were a lot more enjoyable as opposed to, like, I don't know, did he ever write anything, though? I don't think he did. 2001 A Space Odyssey was not.
That was Arthur C. Clarke.
Yeah, so that was Arthur C. Yeah, that was an adaptation. Actually,
he did are you asking if he just did screenwriting, period?
I don't think he ever did, now that I think about it.
No, he co-wrote at least Full Metal Jacket and Eyes Wide Shut.
Okay.
But those are also adaptations.
Yeah, those are also adaptations. Which part of me wonders if maybe, like, if he does an adaptation, it'll be more enjoyable. Because then he'll be within some confines. I don't know.
Right.
Or he'll just ruin something that people love.
Oh shit.
Winnie the Pooh?
Like Winnie the Pooh.
Oh, one thing.
I can't wait for the next episode where I get to just shout off about how much I hate Winnie the Pooh.
Can we do that now? Because
this dumb son of a bitch just wants honey. Like, but why?
No point.
They keep alluding to some sort of psychosexual reasoning behind it, but then nothing happens. And Eeyore's just depressed all the time for no reason. We never get any backstory on that.
I really am looking forward to the first shot of Winnie the Pooh just being Eeyore's mascara streaked face.
The fact that no one has done a mock-up of the Queen of Earth, like, poster with Eeyore is distressing to me.
Oh, anyway, that's kind of wonderful.
Are we finally done talking about this thing?
I don't know. Danny, did you have more to say?
No. All right.
Yeah, we've been talking about this for an hour at least.
Stunning.
Cool. Well, I look forward to never talking about this film again. Blu-rays and DVDs that are coming out. Mad Max Fury Road, which was a great film.
Yeah,
yes, that's kind of it for today.
That's it?
There's not really a lot of other stuff that's coming out. There's Good Kill, which is Ethan Hawke with, what's his face? Someone want to help me out?
Andrew Niccol,
yeah, that's the one. Which I heard is not great, which is upsetting, because he's been good with him before.
I think Backcountry was supposed to be pretty good.
About to say, there's something that's crazy looking called Backcountry.
Yeah.
Oh, was that survivalist horror?
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be a horror movie.
Also, Robin Williams' final film, Boulevard, or at least his last on-screen performance, which I've heard he's quite good in.
The unfortunate tagline of "It's never too late to make a U-turn."
Oh God!
Terrible.
That's not a tagline. That's the subtitle.
Oh, it's Boulevard : It's never too late to make a U-turn.
Speaking of colons in movie titles, did you guys review Mission Impossible: Rogue Nation?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, because I saw it yesterday, and I don't think I saw it. I thought it was great.
Yeah, it's a great film.
I was because I like the Mission Impossible series a lot, but I was kind of shocked at how much I was into it.
That opera scene?
It's you know what's funny, too, is that I was actually in Vienna the week after that movie came out, and when I did like a little tour of the city, and the tour guide said, Tom Cruise was here recently shooting Mission Impossible number 5, which is now in theaters. and then there's like the wide shots. I actually got out of the subway that Simon Pegg gets out of to go into the opera house, and I went, oh, look at that. Anyway, I bring that up because I think that it has, for me, I don't know if this is going to sound like heresy, but after the Queen of Earth talk, what possibly could? I think it has supplanted Mad Max Fury Road as my favorite action film of the year.
I've heard a lot of people say that it's like a toss-up between the two of them.
Because for me, I like Fury Road a lot, but Rogue Nation has like a certain... It's such a clean movie.
It's
so cleanly composed and
structured. The dirtiness of Mad Max, you know? Like, there's such a gritty anger to that movie.
Oh, I do too. It's just that I was surprised during Rogue Nation. Like, I really did not expect to like it that much, but I feel like, you know, since I wasn't around, I will say, if you're listening to the show and you have not seen it yet, it's worth seeing in the theater. We're seeing it on a big screen.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, anyway. Definitely on the big screen. Well, and it is like, and to your point about how you prefer it over Mad Max, I think it is like, it's so difficult to choreograph an action scene while still having, there's so much, just like, so many sight gags, and they're so masterfully done. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when he's in the underwater thing and the giant mechanical arm is like spinning around.
Yeah.
That damn arm.
Yeah, that was great.
If it weren't for that arm. Anyway, well, I'm glad we could end this by agreeing on something. That Rogue Nation is pretty good. I don't agree that it supplants Mad Max, but I can understand why some people would.
Yeah.
And just like that, harmony is restored. And next week we'll talk like this podcast never happened.
Do we know what we're going to do?
I don't know. I don't even know what's coming out.
Anybody got any suggestions?
Pretty grim.
It's pretty grim. We could just talk about Queen of Earth again.
Absolutely not.
All right. So, well, we'll figure it out. Let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found. Danny King.
Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin. And all over the internet. So poke around.
Cool. Amanda Waltz.
You can find me on Twitter at Media Waltz. Also at Media Waltz on, well, just Media Waltz on Letterboxd. And you can also find my blog Steel Cinema on WordPress.
Nick Newman.
Well, you could follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Nick_Newman. You can find my writings at thefilmstage.com, and you can find me enthusing effusively at my new fan site, alexrossperryfans.gov.
Oh, you got that funded by the government.
Yeah. Are you sure? Are you sure you're able to
dot
do biz?
Dot biz. Dot TV. Maybe we could watch Straight Outta Compton.
Oh yeah, I still want to see that.
I still want to see it too, and you know, it's had legs, it's had stand power. I think it's I think it'd be worth talking about. Well, anyway, we'll figure it out. I can be found
on
Twitter.
Guys...
What?
Transporter Refueled.
Oh well, obviously we
should
talk about that.
When I saw the trailer for that, I 1,000% thought that was a car commercial. I thought that trailer was a car commercial when I saw it. I saw it at the gym and it was on mute, and I was like, "Man, this car commercial's been going on for a really long time." And then it. Transporter Refueled. What?
I'm at a walk in the woods with Robert Redford and Nick Nolte.
Oh no. Oh, Nick Nolte needs to go back to the woods.
Oh, I love him.
Oh, snap.
I love him too, but my God.
He was great in Luck. Because apparently I'm just talking about Luck a lot today.
Don't. Why are you bringing up Luck?
Because I loved Luck.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, I don't know. I think I can actually get free passes to A Walk in the Woods.
Don't do it.
I'm not paying for it. I'm not paying for it.
Do not let that sucker you in. All right, well, anyway, I can be found at Brian J. Rowan on Twitter. I can be found at The Film Stage. And I can be found on Letterboxd. And my personal site, dearfilm.net. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Tune in next week. We'll be discussing something. We just don't know what it is.